I'm Ian Danter. This is the Commentator's Curse. This is the show where we lift the lid on the bizarre, weird world that us commentators inhabit. I've been working as a radio commentator for both local and national radio for over 20 years now, for independent radio, mostly BR&B and Talk Sport now. And everybody I meet in a press box has got a different story to tell about how they got started in the business and how they've maintained their role in this business. There's plenty of episodes for you to catch up on in the archive where you found this podcast, including my one-on-one chat with Barry Davis a couple of weeks ago that's proved incredibly popular. Thanks to everyone that's been listening and rating, subscribing and all that. I'm really, really pleased and thankful because there's no money beyond this podcast. It's just me in my spare room. And I've got two guests with me in their spare rooms, by the looks of it, who are joining me for a chat on the Commentator's Curse to talk about their journey. My first guest is a man who's really come to prominence, actually, in the last couple of years due to his work with... Actually, he's run the gamut. He's worked with BT Sport, he's worked with ITV, and he's been working with Sky Sports of late as well on all manner of different football commentaries across the spectrum. Really talented guy. Seb Hutchinson is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hello, Seb.
Hello, Dance. I don't have a spare room in my house. I've got two kids.
There you go. The truth bombs are coming out already. And also joining us tonight is... Well, it's a lady I've known for quite some time. We've often met on press boxes or gantries. We are working for the opposition in each other's eyes, but it doesn't make a scrap of difference because we're getting like a house on fire. And she has really been at the forefront of BBC Five Live's work, also working at a World Cup for the first time when I properly got to know her in Russia 3 years ago. And, of course, with the advent of the Women's Super League, the WSL, she's been front and centre with that too. It's great to have Vicky Sparks with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hello, Vicky.
Oh, great to be with you, Dunce. I'd lend you an ISDN line anytime. Set of headphones, pair of batteries,
I'll hold you to that. You want to be worried. I'll hold you to that when you least expect it. In fact, I'll just yank the headphones out of your ISDN box, whether you need them or not. I'll have them. She said I could. Before I start delving into your respective pasts, I want to start in the present because WSL, I mentioned, actually encompasses both your careers because, Seb, you've done women's football, WSL, and Vicky, I was with you on Sunday. We watched the Manchester United-Arsenal game at Lee Sports Village, and there was one point in the game where Viv Miedemar scored the opening goal. I was only doing updates. You were doing commentary with Lucy Ward for the BBC. But when I did my update, I said as part of my update, you know, Miedemar hit a right-footed effort from 25 yards. I wasn't too sure about Mary Earp's positioning because the ball didn't go into the far corner. It wasn't that far left of centre as I was looking at it. And as I said it, and as I, you know, completed my report, handed back to the studio, I thought, was I being unfair to Mary Earps there? Because that's the first thing that comes into our head. We've got to, and I've got to get, because I'm as guilty of this, that we've got to get it out of our heads that women's football and mistakes within women's football are kind of taboo and not to be mentioned, Vicky. Do you know what I mean?
In that instance, I would agree with you. Phil Neville talked about as well when he was England manager and a lot of the England squad as well, saying, look, we're footballers and we want to be evaluated as footballers. And it was a clever shot by Miedemar. She went one way, looked as though she was going to take the shot early. And I think I said in commentary, you know, it's deceived Mary Earps. Now, I think part of that is knowing that as a commentator rather than a former goalkeeper, for example, you know, I don't want to drill down into the detail of that, but that's what, you know, the pundit is there for. But that was certainly my call, was that, yep, she's been caught out by what Miedemar's done there, and her positioning wasn't good enough to be able to stop it because, as you say, it wasn't quite in the corner, didn't have the pace that you would expect to necessarily get past. But I think that's really, really important. And I guess, you know, as the women's game has more prominence and we're just able to watch more of the women's game, you can make sure that you're making those assessments in the accurate way. But certainly that there shouldn't be a sense of, oh, gosh, I don't think I can call it as I see it. Because that is our job, isn't it, as commentators? We call it as we see it. Sometimes we get it right, sometimes we get it wrong, sometimes we're overly generous, sometimes we're overly critical. And, you know, that's on us to go back and reflect on our own performances as commentators, as it were. But certainly there shouldn't be a fear. And I think certainly the players within the women's game would certainly say we don't want there to be this holding back. We want to be analysed as footballers because that's what we are.
I think the key word is professional. And that's where the women's game is now. We've got professional sides in the WSL. It's the top level of the English game. And therefore, you just have to expect to be criticised, whatever you're doing, you know, you're being paid to play. And that's what's changed from before. And another note to add to that, if I was doing an FA Cup game, whatever level the team is, they could be the ninth tier, or whether the Premier League or the ninth tier, you criticise players exactly the same. If a goalkeeper makes an error, you don't say, oh, you know, they're a semi-professional goalkeeper, you know, or they don't train two times. You just call it out and you say it's a howler. And so I think in this particular case, at a particular point in time, this is where we are. This is what people are going to expect. And this is what the women playing the WSL are going to expect. And I think that's the key point. And in Mary Earps's case, you know, the weekend before when they were playing Everton, she was involved in an incident, a mix-up with her own player. And straight after the game, Mark Skinner, the manager, they were together in conversation and the manager was really annoyed, really disappointed with what had happened. And so if that's coming from the club themselves, you can't argue with that.
And we have to say, defence of Mary Earps as well, she's made some absolutely stunning saves this season too. So, you know, there is always that balance of performance. But yes, Seb's right. You call it as you see it as a commentator. And yes, you know, we have higher expectations of the goalkeepers at the very top of their game. And, you know, we might hone in on their positioning a little bit more when you have players like, you know, David De Gea, for example. You are going to focus very much on those keepers that are at the very top of their game. And Ann-Kathrin Berger in the women's game, you know, I would put Tiana Endler. Again, there's a level there where you are assessing them because they're the best in the world. But fundamentally, like Seb says, if it's a howler, it's a howler. If it's a great save, it's a great save, whatever level and whatever experience you're playing at.
I've only just come into women's football commentary. So for better or for worse, I'm catching up with you guys in terms of knowledge about players. But I'm sensing from what you guys are saying as commentators, you've noticed the huge strides that women's football has made in a very short space of time. Say compared to, if you look at 70s men's football and the pace of it compared to, you know, even if you get to the late 80s, early 90s, there's a perceivable shift. It feels like women's football has gone, you know, a decade's worth of growth in less than 2 or 3 years. Seb, would that be fair comment?
Absolutely. I went to the 2002 FA Cup final at Selhurst Park, and it was Fulham against Donegal's. And Fulham were the only professional side at the time. And Mohamed Al-Fayed had put some money into the women's team for a relatively short space of time, but it was still lauded at the time. And it's what's interesting about that particular game is the attendance was good. There was about 10,000 people. The audience was good. So this perception that the idea of people being interested, I think people have always had an interest. You know, we go back before the game was banned, there were high attendances for women's football. But what's interesting now is in line with the development of men's football as well. And we think about the Premier League, when the Premier League started, you know, there were hardly any foreign players, there were hardly any foreign coaches. The influence on our game now and the quality of young players coming through, there's a larger group of technically gifted young English players. I think the largest I can think of. That's going to have a bleed into the women's game, for sure, because we're seeing clubs align together. Manchester City, these are some of the richest clubs in the world that have women's teams. And you cannot avoid that that's going to filter across. And therefore, the standard would raise. And the money has to be there for these things to happen. And what we do know is the money is there at the top of the men's game, as lower league clubs in men's football know as well. And it's about decision makers and what they're going to do. An example is Newcastle United. How are they going to approach this situation? But what has changed, I think even when the WSL started a couple of years after, Manchester City were involved and they could just sweep up host of the top players and straight away they were, you know, in the mix. I think if Newcastle United tried that now, it would be harder. They'd have to put a significant amount of money into their team if they wanted it to be a title winner overnight, because there's better coaching, there's sides that are more established, there's setups that are more established. And just like they'll find in the men's game, it's going to take them some time to reach the top.
And I think that setup is key. You know, you're seeing investment at the academy level. You know, Leah Williamson starring for Arsenal in England, probably one of that first generation to really come through an academy that had that focused investment. And you're looking at specialist goalkeepers as well. Specialist goalkeeping coaches, I should say, have only been around for a few years in the women's game. You know, Carly Telford talked about going to Chelsea and for the first time in her career, really getting that specialist goalkeeping coaching. So there have been huge strides forward, as Seb says, in the setup side of things. And of course, you're going to see that impact coming through. And I think what's so exciting is you're seeing the young players now coming through that have had the benefit of, you know, kind of 10 years in academies where they're really focused and they're really drilled. And of course, that makes a huge impact in your ability as a senior player, the coaching that you get from a really young age. And it's so exciting to see where the women's game can go with all of that in mind.
Yeah, I just despair at Birmingham's descent from where they were. You think of where they were with Enya Luko and Karen Carney. Marcus Bignett was the coach in the sort of early days of women's football gaining notoriety. And we're probably going back at least a decade here. And they didn't capitalise on that. And now there they are in the bottom two, struggling to stay up with Leicester. But they've, of course, made a change of coach. And good luck to Darren Carter, incidentally. Birmingham City's men's hero at Cardiff in 2002. Right, I'm going back. It's time we went back and talked about you guys and how things got started. Vicky, ladies first. We'll start with you. I'm sure Seb won't mind. Your base is in Newcastle, but I know you've got that there's a London base that's involved. Were you born in London or grew up there? What happened?
Yeah, so I grew up in Surrey. That's where I'm from originally, although I very definitively now do say Newcastle rather than Newcastle, which is what I said growing up. That's from my time in the Northeast, which I'm very proud to call home now. So fell in love with football at an early age. My first experience of football actually was both heartbreak and unbelievable passion and this sense that actually this was an amazing game and it mattered so much, because the first time I ever laid eyes on football was when I was 8 years old. I was woken up by commotion in our living room during Euro 96 and walked down to find England halfway through the penalty shootout in the semi-final. And I'd never watched football before in my life. My dad very briefly explained what penalties were and, you know, what needed to happen. And I saw Gareth Southgate step up to take the penalty, and I saw he missed the penalty, and I had this emotional reaction as an 8-year-old who'd watched 30 seconds of football in her life that, oh, that's really sad. And I didn't even know why, because 30 seconds ago, I didn't know football genuinely. I didn't know it existed. But that was the moment that really caught my imagination. It took a year or so to bed in, I think. I remember the second football match I watched was my dad was on holiday and he wanted my granddad to record a particular football match. And this was in the days, kids, when there were VCRs. Ask your parents what they are if you don't know. But my granddad didn't trust the VCR unless we were all watching the football. He thought somehow if we watched the match, that meant the VCR was recording the football match on tape, which obviously makes no logical sense whatsoever. So he sat us all down, made us watch this football match. In this particular game, somebody scored inside 42 seconds. And I thought, this is good. This is good. I'm sold on this. It wasn't just that penalty thing that I had this emotional reaction to. This is exciting. If goals are scored this quickly, this is something I want to get into. And that began my journey of falling in love with football. And I think for me, growing up as a teenager and going to matches with my dad, it was about the passion. Like, I love the game. I love the skill of the players. But it was the passion and the sense that you got walking into a stadium and cheering on your team and getting in the car and going to an away match and feeling that siege mentality and you were there representing your team. That is what really sucked me in, I think, as a fan about football more than anything. It was a really nice thing to do growing up. And I have to say, you know, there's been a lot of talk recently about what it was like to, or what it is like to go to football matches as a woman. Honestly, when I went growing up, I felt so welcomed. I think that's partly because there is a sense, I feel at football matches, regardless of what club you support, that actually seeing the younger generation come through is so exciting, isn't it? You know, when you walk in and you can tell that a young boy or a young girl is there at their first game and their eyes are so wide and they're just drinking everything in. I think I always felt so much a part of that community. And then as I got older, decided, I'd known for a long time I wanted to go into journalism, thought about news journalism for a long time, but eventually decided on sports and went from there.
I see. Well, Seb, you're a Londoner as well, aren't you?
I am a Londoner, absolutely. I was born in London. My dad was actually born in Birmingham, funnily enough.
Hey!
I thought I'd get that in early for you, Dad.
Good lad.
Yeah. It's quite strange, actually, because I had a strong connection with football in that my dad was a football coach. He was playing at Orient when he was a kid with Laurie Cunningham. They were really good mates.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, really good mates. And then he got a bad injury before he could really get going. And that killed it off for him, really. He went to live in Jamaica for a couple of years. And then when he came back, he went into coaching. So he was in Lillishaw during the 70s, a few years of that. Harry Redknapp, a few other notable people were there. A couple of the 66 guys went into coaching as well. And he was big into football. But I didn't really have an interest in football. When my parents broke up, all of a sudden it burst into life. I got a real interest in. Before that, I was more interested in other sports. Actually, my first big sporting memory was actually the Bruno Tyson fight in 89 and listening to it on the radio and Harry Carpenter and just the legendary comms, Tyson, and all of this. Those sort of moments.
Hit him, Frank.
Get in there, Frank. Yeah, all those sort of moments stay with you forever, and you never lose those moments. I'm not saying at that age I wanted to be a commentator, but it connects you to the emotion of sport. And I add that to David Coleman in 92 with Linford Christie. And, you know, the British captain is the Olympic champion and all of this. And, you know, I used to love the emotion that sport had as a child. But as far as football is concerned, it was more a connection that came about just because of linking to the idea of sport and emotion, watching teams play, watching teams lose or win in a particular situation affected me a lot, and I couldn't shake it. It was the one thing I couldn't shake in life that I would be bothered by it. And it's funny now because even after all these years, I still get emotional watching the England team. Whatever they do, I can't shake it off. So I'll speak to a lot of people and they'll say, I don't care about international football or anything like that. But I've always cared. Since the very beginning, I've always cared. And Vicky mentioned Euro 96 and, you know, I've worked with Gareth Southgate, you know, over the years. And I said to him, you know, you were responsible for one of the times I cried watching football. His response was, oh, thanks very much. Yeah. you know, those particular moments, as I've said before, in other sports, they never leave you. But with football, I felt a connection to it. And I love football early 90s, talking into the mid 90s. When it comes to commentary, I am in a unique position, I would say, in a minority of children, knowing what they want to do from quite a young age. And I must have been maybe 10, 11. And I knew I wanted to be a football commentator. And it didn't waver in the time since. It's not wavered at any point. And I've had other roles I've done in telly where I thought I could just settle in this and I could do this. But having that bug, having it always there, has meant that I've been focused on continuing and wanting to do that.
That's really interesting because as people will know who've listened to this podcast regularly, my route was completely unorthodox. Having been a guitar salesman in Birmingham in the 90s, and then, you know, a phone call led to doing some silly comedy sketches, which led to being a flying eye travel reporter, which led to football. Honestly, the route was, it's just the most nonsensical route that you could imagine. But I know there's much more of a traditional flavour to the routes you two went down. Seb, I'll get to your specific, because there's a specific part of your route that really interests me in a moment. But Vicky, did you study journalism at college, university, that sort of thing?
No, I did quite a lot of research and spoke to people in the industry about what the best way to get in was, and everyone recommended whatever they'd done. So I took from that you could do a variety of things and get into the industry. So I studied English. And
what age was this, Vicky? How old were you at the time?
I was probably 14, 15. That was the time where I was thinking, yeah, this is what I want to do. And it wasn't, for me, it's a slightly different path in that I did not think about commentary for a long time. So I knew that I wanted to do sports journalism. I then, that developed into broadcast journalism probably around when I was 18, 19, because I love the theatre, I love being on stage. And I thought, well, it's the best of both worlds, isn't it? You know, you get to write a bit in terms of your writing your match reports or whatever, but you get to perform, which is what I really enjoyed. Mm. And so commentary came much later for me. But I did English. And then the one thing everyone said was do some sort of media law qualification, just so you don't libel people, basically. So I did a 2-day course in that with the London School of Journalism, and then went down the work experience route, got as much work experience as I could with local radios, BBC Surrey, BBC Newcastle, and then kind of worked my way up from there.
Yeah, well, there was a nod of recognition from Seb there about the media law thing, right, Seb? Because I know that, having spoken to other people on this podcast, Sam Matterface went down the hospital radio route, which is a lovely traditional way that lots of people get into radio. What's becoming more of a tradition now, and I'll include you in this, Seb, is that people take specific media, sports media training courses. And you went to the one that I'm aware of up in Staffordshire, which I think is run by Mitch Price, the former TV director I got to know well. So
yes.
Explain what that entailed. What led you to that, to sort of train you up to become the person you ultimately became?
So because I said, you know, I wanted to become a commentator from 11 or 12, I was already in my mid-teens trying to get work experience. So I worked on the first sort of series of Robot Wars. There was Watchdog, What Not to Wear, and in the latter days, a show called Trevor Nelson's Urban Choice, which is like a music show, and they had musicians coming on it. And I think on the one I was on, it was Roots Maneuver, I think. A really young Destiny's Child had been on it the week before, but there was like emerging artists were coming through, and you'd get to experience that. And I knew about, you know, as you can imagine, when anybody's keen about something, they write to people, you know, they send letters, and then it became emails, but, you know, sent letters and saying, I want to do this. I want to be this. Can I do this? Will you let me do this? So I knew about the idea of hospital radio. But being from London, the idea of local radio is a bit twisted, because at that time you had, you know, BBC London, and Capital Gold. You know, Capital Gold, a behemoth really in commercial radio, as you know so well, Dan. But, you know, those sort of moments you're thinking, well, there's no way I'm ever going to be commentating for these huge companies, you know, in my mid-teens. Absolutely no chance. And especially when you're a kid from East London, you sort of think to yourself, and also these guys, I know I won't get on with them. They won't know anything about me. I won't, like, connect with them and all this sort of stuff. So you have those doubts in your mind. So I thought, and I remember thinking it early, you have to arm yourself as an individual. Create yourself, because people always say it's who you know, not what you know. But I think that's a bit of a skewed thing, because you need to, it is who you know, but when you get there, you need to know. That's how I see it. So you should always arm yourself, I think. Read up on the subject, read up on the people that are working there, study what you think made them do well, what you need to fit in culturally as well. It's just, you know, that's changed in recent years, but that was a big thing then. You have to think, right, I have to think like these people. I have to, you know, behave like these people, even, you think, as a teenager. So this was all played in my mind. And part of arming yourself was, you know, doing courses. So I did an undergrad at Royal Holloway University in media arts. I'd done my A-levels in media. You could see that I did a GCSE in media. It was one of the first years they were doing that sort of thing. So you can see where this is going.
Doing GCSEs, you didn't have that. Mind you, it was O-levels when I was doing
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
No O-level media.
Well, they added the S in by my age, so yeah. But yeah, so I did. I thought I'm doing the work experience, I'll do the academia, I'll study things, you know, how to use your voice, voiceover training. But the course that popped up in Staffordshire, you know, I'd completed my undergrad, and it was the first year of the master's element of this course. So I thought, you know, this sounds perfect, exactly what I want to do, broadcast journalism. This seems exactly what I need, you know, a place to get yourself ready, do things, make mistakes, and you're paying to be there rather than being paid. So they'll let you make those mistakes, and you can make 100 of them to improve yourself. And, you know, doing that course was a fantastic way of just building that personal, you know, knowledge database, I would say, and understanding, you know, what it might take to do well. But I'd say that was only, doing that master's course was only, I'd say, 10% of what happened after that in terms of making where I am, I'd say, because there's a bigger element, but we'll get to that.
But it's a grounding, isn't it? It's a grounding. It's and as you say, you're allowed to make as many mistakes as you like, and you don't get berated for them. You just get told, okay, well, look, this is maybe how it should be done instead. And I like that. And I love Mitch. He's a terrific guy and a lovely operator. And you're one of a number of people that have benefited from his years of wisdom working as a match director or, you know, the myriad of jobs he's held within ITV. He's a lovely man, and he continues to churn out great, you know, graduates from that.
And he loves the baggies.
He does. Well, you know, we've all got our cross to bear, but we'll let him off that. So, Vicky, when did Newcastle come into the picture? Because obviously we talked a lot about Surrey and being in and around the capital, so that's a long way to the northeast.
It is. Up there? Yeah, so I went to Durham University, and in my final year was the year that BBC Sport were moving to Salford. So it was a choice between going back down south to where I grew up and pursuing things with BBC Surrey, who were great, love working with them, or staying up and doing work experience with BBC Newcastle, who I'd started working with, just work experience in my final year at uni. And because of the move to Salford, the southeast and London had suddenly become incredibly competitive. You had a lot of very experienced journalists, reporters and commentators who weren't necessarily going to go to Salford. So everything was just becoming more competitive. And I think similarly to what Seb was thinking as a teenager, I thought there's no way that, you know, I'm going to get even an entry level job here, because they're being competed for at the moment, at this time, by people with far more experience than me. So I decided to stay up in the northeast. I got a job in a sandwich shop. My main priority was to find somewhere that would feed me for free. So I chose my favourite sandwich shop that I went to at university. Was doing work experience at BBC Newcastle. And I gave myself, basically, in my head, I gave myself a timeline of 2 years to get a paid shift with BBC Newcastle. Now, I made that timeline really long because I didn't want to feel under pressure. But I felt that I'd always been really encouraged, particularly by my parents, to do what I was passionate about. And I knew that this was what I really wanted to do. But I also wanted to be realistic about it. And so for me, it was important to set a kind of timeline to say, look, if you haven't, you know, made some sort of inroads in 2 years, that doesn't mean you have to give up on it. You might reassess, you might think other opportunities, but you might also think, you know what, this isn't quite working, maybe I'll pursue a different path. So fortunately, within those 2 years, did get a shift with them, and it went on from there. Took the casual route, worked on every show going, read the travel bulletins, produced mid-morning, produced the afternoon show, and did a lot of the phones on the Total Sport BBC Newcastle show. So answered all the calls coming in as the broadcast assistant, and from there progressed on to more on-air stuff, presenting-wise with them. But I never actually did commentary at local radio level. I remember my editor saying to me once, because those gigs that you get at a place like BBC Newcastle. I mean, Nick Barnes, who's fantastic, does the Sunderland commentary for them, has done for years. Mick Lowes was there for about 25 years, a real legend of broadcasting in the Northeast. Now Matthew Raisbeck, who's brilliant as well, does the Newcastle commentary. Those are jobs that once you've got them, you really do hang on to them. And so just because of the patch, it was a brilliant patch to cover in terms of sport. But I remember my editor saying to me, you're going to get opportunities at Network before you get opportunities here, because it was just their way of doing things. They didn't rotate the commentaries. You know, you were the Newcastle commentator or you were the Sunderland commentator, and that was that sort of thing. Well, but I'd never thought about commentary really until a colleague suggested me applying for a commentary course when Five Live got the rights for the WSL. So...
And here's the thing, because last week I had Mark Donaldson saying that he got his first commentary completely by accident because the bloke who was meant to be doing it forgot his glasses. So Mark had to do the game because the bloke couldn't see a thing, his hand in front of his face. And it's kind of a developing theme on this podcast that lots of people's first game have fallen into their lap when they least expected it. Would that be the case for you two guys? I'll start with you, Seb.
Oh, because you know what? I can't remember my first game. This is the unbelievable thing.
I know.
But I think the reason is because of, well, there's two reasons, I think, probably why I've forgotten. One is the fact that I wanted to do it for so long that it's almost like it wasn't like a story in my mind that goes, oh, and this happened, you know. It's more as I wanted to do it, and then I was doing it and the ball was still rolling. But also just how I got into television and how I got into doing commentary eventually, because I went an unconventional route in that I started and I got my break really in television properly in terms of getting paid properly as a producer, you know, an editorial assistant, they were called, you know, assistant producer, junior producer in television. And I took that opportunity on and I focused in that area because I wanted to learn about television and how it works and all aspects of it. And I thought, this is how I want to approach this, to the point where when the commentary opportunities come, and I say when, because that's how your brain thinks when you're younger, when I get this chance, I'd be ready for it. So I more sort of went into a mode of just becoming a TV professional. And therefore, when I did start to commentate more and more, and it built as more as part of what I was doing as a freelancer when I went freelance, I cannot generally think what my first commentary was, which is incredible because I think almost every other commentator would be able to tell you, but I haven't got that story.
Can you not even pin it down to a year?
No, a year. I want to say 07, maybe. Well, I tell you what, I started pursing my lips. I tell you what, my first commentary was probably in 1994 when I was using the big-headed football figurines made by Corinthians, and I had them all laid out on... No, it was an old Sabutio pitch, effectively, yeah. With Sabutio goals, but I had the big-head football figurines, and I had all the teams, and the teams that were in the Premiership, you know... FA Carling Premiership, I would try and act the games out there, and I recorded those games, and I still have those tapes, so they're locked away, never to be seen by anybody, unless it's the British Museum or something, maybe.
Dag nabbit, we deserve. They've got to be heard. Stick them in a time capsule. Do you know that you mentioned those figurines? It's really funny. My audition for Shopping Telly. I did Shopping Telly for about 4 or 5 years in the early 2000s. And my audition was to sell a set of the figurines for the Corinthians ones that you just mentioned. They didn't know I did football. I'd just come in for an audition at this place in Redditch that is now called Gems TV. It wasn't then. It was something completely different. And they just shoved these figurines, says, right, you've got 2 minutes to sell those to me. Off you go. So there we go. We are linked somehow, Seb, by those ridiculous...
Can you remember what ones they were?
Goals, Beckham, Nicky Butt. I'm pretty sure Robbie Savage was in there.
Home kit or away kit?
Home kit.
Home kit, yeah.
Home kit. There were some England ones in there. Rio Ferdinand was in there. Now, was it David James? It might have been David James as goal kit. But yeah, honestly, I'd verbal diarrhea for 2 minutes. I got the job. I mean, you know, if they've told me to flog a set of pots and pans,
yeah,
I'd be it all over. I would never have passed the audition with that. But yeah,
I still have a Matthias Sammer in the box, pristine Dortmund away strip, probably worth about £13. But I still have it. Who knows? Who knows?
It could be a family heirloom. That.
Yeah. I'll put it in the will.
Yeah. See, we've moved on from Sabutio now, folks. We talked a lot about, but now we're moving on to the big hitters, the Corinthians figurines. Vicky, you must know. I elicit it surprise at Seb not quite remembering when his first game was. Yours? Bet you know.
I do. It was because it came as a surprise. It wasn't a you're doing it tomorrow because someone's got their glasses surprise, but it was my editor at BBC London who I'd done a lot of reporting for. And I think that was the thing. When I decided I wanted to go into broadcasting, I thought reporting. Commentary hadn't crossed my mind. I don't really know why, but I thought I could do reporting. I listened to a lot of it. That's what I was targeting. So I'd done a lot of reports for them. And he called me up and said, would you like to do commentary of Middlesbrough against Charlton in the Championship? It was going to go out online, I think, for BBC London and then on BBC Kent's AM frequencies for some reason. And I remember I had a friend visiting from Australia who thankfully was into football, but I said, do you mind actually? I know you're only up for the weekend, but can we go to Middlesbrough Charlton? Talked to her about it and said, yeah, I really don't know. I honestly don't know if I'm going to be any good at it. And she said, well, why don't we just do it? Like, you know, it's going to be fun. You can give it a go. And I remember sitting in the car at the Riverside and we had a little pray in the car and then we walked in and it was the most nervous I've been in my life because I honestly just didn't know. And actually, because I'd not thought about commentary, I think I managed to practice that week over, you know, a match of the day or something and have a little practice, but it wasn't something that I'd been working on. And I got through it. It was 1-0. I remember that. I remember the keeper had a bit of a dodgy mistake for the goal. So we called that and really enjoyed it. But again, was thinking, oh, maybe, maybe not. And I think that the turning point for me was when the BBC won the rights for radio to commentate on the WSL in 2014. And they used that to set up a commentary training program, basically for people that had done some commentary but weren't necessarily hugely experienced, and with the idea of bringing through some people, maybe from local radio, to join the network pool of commentators and give people an opportunity that wouldn't necessarily have one. And Nick Barnes, the Sunderland commentator at BBC Newcastle, just sent me this email and said, oh, I think you should apply for this. And I thought, oh, I don't know, but then decided to. And I think the second game that I did was the one where I thought, this is what I would love to do. Like, I still loved doing the reporting, but I thought, you know what, actually, I could develop in this way as well. It was Chelsea women against Everton women, and Rachel Williams scored inside 37 seconds. It was my second commentary ever, first on Five Eyes Sports Extra. So again, really, really nervous. And when somebody scores inside 37 seconds, you either sink or swim. Luckily, Chelsea have really clear shirts. I was able to see the goal clearly, called it, looked down at the watch, was able to say in 37 seconds. And obviously, when I listened back to it, there was so much to work on. But there was a sense that I felt, and I can only describe it as, it was the feeling I felt when I walked on stage as a teenager. It was the feeling of acting, of being in front of an audience and performing. And it felt the same. And I loved theatre so much when I was growing up. And the fact that it felt the same as that made me think, you know what, this is me. Like, this is a part of me that actually I could really pursue and enjoy. So it was the second commentary, but that was the light bulb moment for me, I think.
I've got to clear this up because I'm a bit confused here. Don't tell me your mate from Australia who'd come all the way over ended up being your summariser at Middlesbrough Charlton. You made it sound like she was sat next to you.
We just Lucy did. No, it was Marco Gabbiadini. Oh. Who I knew very, very well from BBC Newcastle. So he came along and, summarised with me and was absolutely brilliant. And Lucy, bless her, just sat on the end, watched the game, had a good time. We went and got pizza and went home. It was
rock and roll.
Well, Dance, I can remember the first goal I commentated on, which was, so it was David Burrows in a Coventry kit, massive head. I think he's made of, I don't know what they were made of, rubber or plastic. I don't know what they were made of, those big-headed footballers.
It was plastic.
But he whipped it into the top corner of the Sabutio goal. The goal flew across the room because they weren't built for that. And I had to press stop on the tape recorder. Yeah, that was it.
And you never had a drama like that again, sir. That's
pinnacle. This is, I think, the public are going to start demanding that this has to be this has to be seen. Was there a breakthrough moment for you, Seb? I know, you know, thinking about the first commentary isn't straightforward, but was there a moment like Vicky's just talked about there, that sort of?
Oh, in terms of being in. Oh gosh, that's. Do we ever feel in? I don't know what you mean. The big break. Well, like I said, it's so different to normal paths in that most people who want to get into, say, broadcast journalism, they start doing some form of it quite early doors, be it even if it's just match reports or going to do interviews with people. But mine didn't really work like that. You know, my break into television was as a producer, you know, creating creative pieces or being in the trucks at games, coordinating replays, being on site directing shoots. So in terms of feeling like I was getting somewhere, I'd say it would have to be when I left, because I was staff at ITV and I left in 2011 to go freelance. But just before, a couple of years before that, Al Jazeera had started using ITV's facilities as they launched their English language channel. And through that, I got opportunities to voice stuff, got opportunities to commentate on some games as well. And around that time, there was also a system going on at Perform in Feltham, and they were doing betting website commentaries. So I do that. I try and fit that in on the side as well. But it wasn't...
Was that like Argentinian second division?
Absolutely, yeah. UAE, then Danish fourth tier. Basically, people will bet on anything, as we know, you know. But you get yourself in a system. We're in a room with what felt like 100 other people speaking 100 languages, and you're all commentating on games at the same time. And it was like a chicken coop, basically. But you had your headphones on, so you had an element of cushion from all the noise around you. But it was quite funny because I'd be doing a game and there'd be somebody else doing the same game in Spanish and French. And I know a bit of Spanish, which actually made it worse, because there was one guy when I was commentating on games and he was copying everything I said during the game. So I would say something and he'd say it really quickly, and I'd say something and he'd say it really quickly. And after a while, I was getting quite annoyed. You could imagine I was getting quite annoyed about it. I thought, well, I can't really do anything about it. You can't stop someone from talking. But that was when knowing that bit of Spanish was unhelpful, because the French guy could have been doing the same and I wouldn't have known. that's for sure. But I'd say those were the moments where I thought, well, I'm starting to get my voice out there. But when I left ITV in 2011 and I went freelance, I did a lot more commentaries for Al Jazeera. But then I also started working for BT Sport when they started. And straight away from there, from the very start, I was doing voiceover work with them on the WSL, incidentally. They had UFC, they had National League. So that's when, as a freelancer, you started thinking, right, okay, I'm getting somewhere here. And
what you said before really interested me, and I'm sure this interests Vicky too, because actually Vicky straddles the worlds of radio and television. She does both. You're pretty much television and I'm radio. I've never done television in my life. But from what you've told me, the prospect of working on television would terrify me, simply because I don't have the knowledge that all those years you spent as an assistant producer or working in the trucks, whatever it may be, everything that informed you about, yes, this, you know, the crazy world of television, it sounds to me like it's a totally different world to the crazy world of radio. I mean,
I totally agree. And that's why I can't pinpoint those first moments, because I didn't have the fear of doing a television commentary because I understood television. So it wasn't, oh, I don't know what to expect here. I would just see it as I'm commentating on a football match. I wasn't thinking in terms of television. When I started doing some radio with 5Live, it was more of a shift in thinking. So I had to think more, because I didn't know the processes of radio per se. So that was more like starting again. But because I'd always thrown myself into difficult situations, work, I'd done all sorts of jobs in telly and been to all sorts of places, the idea of fear never would cross my mind. It was more, right, I'm going for this full throttle. Nothing's going to stop me. I'm focused. But always, I'd always think, focused, don't take any rubbish from anybody at any point, but be nice. That's always been my philosophy. I'm a nice person until somebody's a little bit difficult with me. And then I just, a little bit of a switch. And that's always the sign. I always think, you know, that's how you have to approach life sometimes. I think you should always be a good person. But if somebody is difficult with you, you should be able to stand up for yourself. That's always the sort of situation or the place I've been in, I think.
Vicky?
Even now, when I alternate quite regularly between the two of them, I have to remind myself what I'm doing. Not because I don't know, you know, I'm aware when I'm on a country, whether I'm doing TV or radio. But I think you have to be very intentional about switching that mindset. And Conor McNamara is someone that again, I listen to and really admire the way that he does that, because he does a lot of TV and radio and also switches sports as well with the TV stuff. And I think they're just such different disciplines, you know. I mean, it sounds really obvious, but radio, it is literally the primary thing. Where is the ball? What direction is it going in? Which team has it? And you're constantly using geography, even left and right, which are your staples for radio, suddenly become redundant in television. You know, if you throw in the odd one here and there, but everyone can see they're going down the left wing. Like, that's what they're doing. You need to enhance. I think I was told very early on when I was doing some training for television, you know, TV commentary is all about enhancing what's happening, whereas radio is very much more descriptive. And yes, you're enhancing, you're bringing in humour, you're bringing in stats, you're entertaining as well. But fundamentally, you are telling people where the ball is. And I think actually listening to radio growing up as a fan, I think that is still so the key for me, because when you're listening to the radio, very often you might be in the car, you don't have access to television, you can't and shouldn't be checking your phone. So you are so reliant on the radio commentator. And most people listen to radio commentary, yes, might be because they're neutrals and they like football, but a lot of the time it's because they're desperate to know how their team is doing. And I think it's always keeping that in the back of your mind with radio. But I think for me, being very intentional about, okay, today I'm doing television, and just even just reminding yourself of that for 10 seconds and go through, okay, what are the key things? Because I listen back to my commentaries and I have reams and reams of things that I want to work on and things that I think went well. And I'm always assessing what I've done and what I can improve. So what are my one thing to work on, I call it. And so what is that for television and what is that for radio? And reminding myself just at the beginning of a commentary for 10 seconds or so, this is what I'm working on today. This is what I'm focusing on. And then you do that and you get better at that, and then something else drops off. So you have to go back to something else. But that's the way of it.
Do you, either of you guys, have a mentor in mind when you think back to how you've developed as a commentator, somebody that was particularly influential to you? Seb, was there anybody in mind particularly there?
I tell you what, my mentor is somebody I never met, actually. And I would say it's Brian Moore as a commentator, because he, for me, was a template of how I wanted to commentate. And also getting into my mind what is important in commentary for me. And I always think it's about, because a lot of people say, you know, as a television commentator, you're not the most important thing. The game's the most important thing. But what a television commentator can do is just add, you know, as Vicky said, enhance it, add something to it. What you never want to be doing is dragging the game down or make it feel like people are distracted by your presence in any way. And that's what I loved about Brian Moore, because when you think about his great commentaries or great lines or, you know, amazing wordplay, it wasn't really about that with him. It was just almost feeling like a father figure watching the game with you, and just those little moments. It can be, and I said it before with Harry Carpenter and Dave Conway, just even noises, even a sort of, you know, Barry Davis was great at that. Yeah. It's an emotional thing, football, and because it's such a universal sport, you've got such a cross section of society watching a football game. You almost feel like you have to try and connect with people emotionally, and you have to simplify your commentary right down. And of course, you want to have a large vocabulary, but what you do want is to make sure that everybody watching understands what you're saying, understands every word you're saying, and feels the emotion of the game in your voice. And I used to think Brian Moore did that really well, especially during the era when I was listening to his commentary when he was getting older. So he's obviously got that gravitas added to it with his age. Yeah. Same with David Coleman, you know, even in races where I think David Coleman covered a 100-meter race, and I think he lost his voice in the middle of the 100-meter race. But even him trying to get his voice back, it still worked. It's like, Frankie Fredrickson. And it was a bit like that. But it's still, for me, it still sticks. And I still get like a nostalgic chill about that. And because it's live, because commentary is live, you are always in the moment of an event. So therefore, your reaction to anything is instinctive. And it shouldn't sound premeditated. It should sound like, this is how you feel in this moment. It's almost like you're shocked. And we often have to do spoof commentary where we know what's going to happen and we have to almost sound like we know. But because it's a spoof commentary, we don't want to sound like we don't know what we're talking about. So we might prepare for it. We make sure we know who scored the goal and who's crossed it in. But I can always tell the difference, always.
Yes.
And that goes to the heart of what I'm trying to say, in that even in the moments where commentators slightly got something wrong in the build-up to a goal, slightly misrepresented a goal. I heard Clive's talking about 99 final and saying, he was still talking about deflected and in on that first goal. But to me, it just doesn't really matter, because what matters is the moment and the feeling of emotion in that moment. And if you're half asleep when you're commentating on a big moment, that for me is the unforgivable element of it.
Do you know what, Seb? Yeah. You're dead right about those spoof commentaries, the tacked-on commentaries. I can spot them a mile off. And I don't know whether the casual viewer can as well. And this is no reflection on the guys that do it and the girls that do it. But when you're listening to a highlight show and there's suddenly I think the way I can tell is that they start the commentary for a builder to go with a stat, as though, that's not how a commentary would normally start. But normally, Bournemouth coming forward here. They've had a pretty quiet opening 15 minutes, but there's Dan Juma, and suddenly it's in. Hang about. You knew that. Yeah, I completely concur with you on that, Seb. You can spot those a mile off. Sorry, Vicky, I was going to come to you and ask about a mentor. You mentioned Nick Barnes a couple of times at BBC Newcastle, who does the Sunderland commentaries, who I love dearly. Was he up there?
Yeah, definitely. And Mick Lowe's as well. I remember very early on, actually listened back to some of that Chelsea women, Everton women, and gave me some pointers, which I still have. I think I've been really lucky to benefit, as so many of us have, from the training that Rob Nothman gives for the BBC. He is just absolutely superb, particularly in reporting, but also commentary as well. I think over the years, his advice and his perception of commentary is just so spot on. He's one of these people that he'll always start with three positives and then give you something to work on, which is just, that's just music to my ears. It's so helpful when people give feedback like that.
And yet Rob is not known as a commentator.
No, which is so interesting, because he knows everything about it, but he would feel and he would say that his strengths lie in kind of other areas. But I think the way that he views commentary, the experience that he has in training people and just knowing the industry, I suppose in the same way that, many of us commentators weren't professional footballers, but from watching football for so long, you get the appreciation for it and you can analyse it and you can assess it, which is obviously our jobs. And Rob, I think, is almost like that commentator of commentary in a way that, he's just been absorbed in it for so long and he understands it so well that he gives those insights. And I have to say Guy Mowbray as well at Match of the Day has done some of that for me as well and has really helped me from a TV perspective and has taken on that role for me, which has been so helpful. And I've learned a lot from such a conversational style of doing things. I think when you watch Guy on Match of the Day, you just feel like you and him are having a chat. He's so good at bringing the viewer into the experience of a goal or a chance and look at that down there. It's the way that you would communicate that to your mate in the pub. If you're rewatching a game, particularly over replays, I think he's so good at doing that.
So tell me about that feeling, Vicky, when you were told you're going to Russia, you're going to commentate at your first World Cup.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember how I felt when I was told I was going to South Africa 8 years before, and I was absolutely panning myself. I don't mind telling you, I was all over the place. But I that's when I first met you out in Russia, because we were all based at that Radisson Hotel in the centre of Moscow, and flying hither and thither. Tell me about that experience for you.
Yeah, I think it's one of those that. So initially I got told by radio that they wanted me to go. And I honestly, I don't think I took it in for a long time. I think you're almost like just semi in shock. I was like, okay, yeah, great. No, that'd be great. Thank you very much. And then, you're kind of just processing everything about that. And then, TV came and said, if you're out there with radio, we'd quite like you to, do a couple of TV games. And they kind of had to talk me into it, because at that stage I'd had more experience with radio and was the thought of, for Seb, I mean, Seb, it might not for you have been, because you had the experience coming through television and you always knew you wanted to do that. I think at that point, I think I had done a few FA Cup Match of the Day, so I've been doing that sort of thing. But to do a live TV game was something that I had thought I was light years away from doing, to be honest. So, yeah, they did a good job of, you know, kind of saying, no, we think you are ready to do this. And, it was an unbelievable experience. I think when you're in the middle of everything, you are just so head down and focused. And because I was doing TV and radio, I mean, I stayed in Moscow for the whole time and did quite a bit of off tube, which again, I hadn't really done much off tube. So that was interesting. But yeah, you're so head down and focused on what you're doing. And I think actually afterwards, when I reflected on the experience, I was fortunate that for various kind of changing around, I stayed out to do a week reporting after I'd finished my commentaries, doing some stuff for World Service. And that was really, really nice, actually, because I think when I was in the midst of it, I had no time to take it in. And actually, you're trying not to. I think you really don't want to sit there and reflect about what you're doing, because that just distracts you mentally. You just want to focus. It's any other game, you know. We hear it from footballers all the time, you know, what's it like to play in this huge match, and you know, well, it's any other game, and you know, either everything's either a cup final or it's just another game. So whatever perspective you take on it, but I think that's it. I know, I was very much like, it's just another game, because as soon as you start thinking, oh my gosh, it's a World Cup, oh my gosh, it's my first live TV commentary, oh my gosh, it's on BBC One, you're gone. Like, mentally, you're gone. So it's just another game. No one's watching. No one's listening. It's just another game. That's what you tell yourself. So actually, to have that week afterwards where I was doing reporting and to kind of sit there and go, oh, right. And honestly, it was a real sense of excitement, but it was also, thank goodness it's out of the way. Like, first one out of the way, and then it's done, and then you can just focus on what you love, which is commentating. And I think that was... It was a weird mix of emotions, I think, doing that first one.
Well, Seb, I know you're itching to do a World Cup as a commentator, but you really came to prominence for me with the Euros that have just gone, with your work that you did for ITV. I mean, all right, the Euros isn't the World Cup, but it's damn close. So a lovely moment for you, I'm sure, to get the call to join the ITV team for that tournament.
Well, this is what, you know, goes back to the idea of remembering your first time in football commentary. What I will say is that, so Qatar, when I work with Qatar with ITV, it will be my fourth World Cup, men's World Cup that I've worked on. So again, it goes into that mind of, I've been to World Cups, not as a commentator, but I've been to World Cups in actually various guises. So in South Africa, I was there as just an assistant producer. In Brazil, I was there for the host, doing all sorts of things. I was there to sort of cover the whole competition from behind the scenes. So I was everywhere in all aspects of producing and putting together a World Cup. You know, I had to be and cover every aspect of it. And then in Russia, I was there doing voiceover for the, which is essentially like a sort of preview show program for the host broadcaster. Mm-hmm. And then I've been to Rugby World Cups, been to FIFA Women's World Cups as well. But the Euros just happened. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, that I love international football. I'm one of those people who just loves it to bits. And I think covering the Euros, I was really excited. Wasn't nervous, just excited, because even though it wasn't full of fans, it wasn't completely full of fans, and it was spread out over the country, and a lot of the stuff we had to do off tube. But even having those moments, you know, to cover what I consider with international tournaments, is they become landmark moments, because even though the Premier League is, you know, the worst, most watched league in the world, international tournaments are the things that stick in people's minds. People never forget those moments. Going back, even in World Cups where you weren't even alive for, you know those signature moments, be it 1970, Carlos Alberto, be it Maradona against England in 86. And these moments go on, and they never, ever leave our memories. So it was a great honour to be on that particular competition with ITV. And so when it comes to the World Cup, it'll be exactly the same. I'll be excited for that because they don't happen that often. I know FIFA want them to happen more often, but, you know, keeping the 4 years, having that cycle flicking between them, as you were.
I think what helped me when I did my first ever World Cup game, which was in Johannesburg, it was a big enough game. It was Argentina, Nigeria, so it's Messi, for one thing. Maradona is the coach. Gabby Ainz is playing, who is playing really well for Manchester United at the time. The Nigerians that, you know, everyone was thinking now is an African team finally going to really progress and go deep into a World Cup. But you know what? What really helped me that day was having Mickey Quinn alongside me, a guy who's just unaffected by anything around him. As you tend, never mind excited, not nervous. He was just funny, not nervous. And it's funny how having somebody like him around you puts you so much at ease when your stomach's churning, your heart's going 10 to the dozen. It's really nice when you have somebody alongside you who can just, by acting like a clown, as Mickey often did, it doesn't half help somehow in a strange way.
Oh, we love having co-coms. It's one of my favourite parts of the job because you're sharing an experience with somebody and there's nothing better than sharing an experience. We can all have a great experience on our own, you know, in whatever it might be, but it's almost like it's never truly a fantastic experience unless there's somebody else with you, at least one person with you, because then you can just talk about it. You can talk about those moments and they will never go away. Whereas if it's something, you know, if I covered a game on my own, so I covered a few handball world championships, right? And those were solo comms. And I, you know, went to some great places for that, you know, but it's just in my brain and nobody else's brain. I was one of only two English speaking, like native English speaking people working on these productions. So I don't even have anybody back here. Oh, do you remember the Handball World Championship when we were in Albertville and it was snowing? And, you know, so it's just in my head. Whereas with all these competitions in football, when you do them with somebody else, it's fantastic. And that just, not just your co-com, but the team as well. Going with a TV team, and as you know, Dancing and Vicky, even with a radio team, you become a team, you become a unit, and you share in that experience.
Just quickly before, we have a team B from TalkSport of the World Cup in Russia. Team B was myself, Adrian Durham, Matt Holland, Declan McCarthy, our producer, and Will Dowie, Ian Dowie's son, who was our Russian fixer. He studied Russian at university, so he was our translator, which we instantly queried on day two when he ordered a pizza with no mushrooms in a restaurant and it arrived with extra mushrooms. So we thought, how good is your Russian, actually? But to this day, we still have a little WhatsApp group between the five of us that nobody else is part of. And that camaraderie that we forged as a fivesome during that month in Russia, you're friends for life. I don't wish to get too hokey about it, but that's what it is, Vicky, isn't it? It's just, you know, the friendships you forge.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, it's the whole team, isn't it? You know, the engineers, the producers, the broadcast assistants, the guys back at base who put it all together in the studio. I think in terms of summarizers, I mean, I genuinely absolutely love every summariser that I've worked with for different reasons. But I remember Pat Nevin was my summariser for the first radio Premier League game I did for Five Live, which was Everton Burnley. And anybody who's ever sat in the press box at Everton Burnley, at Goodison Park, knows about the pillar. And the pillar basically means that if there's a corner, you can choose between seeing the penalty spot or seeing the 6-yard box. You can't choose both. So one of you has to go one way and one has to go the other. And I remember we were about 10 minutes in and Pat, they will always put Pat with debut commentators on Five Live because he is this good. And he's so calm. He's so assured. He will back you to the hill. I mean, he'd almost rather change reality to back you up than contradict you. I mean, he will call it, you know, but particularly for those first ones. And I remember 10 minutes in, he just said on air something like, you know, and I'm, Vicky, you know, we've got to mention, I mean, I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it already, this pillar that is just in our way of, you know, seeing the penalty area, you know, it's so difficult to see around. And I knew immediately why he'd done it. It was because if, on my first commentary on Five Live, which I was so nervous and hyped about and excited, if a goal went in the penalty area and I couldn't see it because of the pillar, he'd already given me the out. Because as a commentator, you can't go, oh, gosh, well, I didn't really see that. There was a pillar. But he made sure that he mentioned it really early on, just so that the viewers knew that, you know, there was a potential obstruction. So if later on in the match, if I was struggling with that, and thankfully I didn't, Jeff Hendricks scored down the other end, one goal, it was fine. And it was helpful because Burnley Club Radio were yelling, Hendrick, from about 10 seconds before he actually hit the shot. So I was like, yeah, it's definitely him. Could go with that. So that was helpful. But it was just, it was such a thoughtful thing to do. And nobody would have realised why he was doing it. But it was that care and attention to detail and just that sense that he was really looking out for you and had your back completely the whole way. And that makes such a difference when you're doing your first game. And like you said, Dan, you know, when you're doing that World Cup game and your nerves are up and the adrenaline's going and, you know, all of that stuff can lead you, when the adrenaline's so high, it can lead to brilliant commentary, but it can also lead to mistakes because you're just so pumped and you're not taking necessarily the time that you normally take. Well, and I just thought, brilliant, Pat.
I can think of two instances, like where, for example, myself and Ray Parler flew down to Port Elizabeth. No producer, no engineer, because TalkSport were working on a strict budget in South Africa. So me and him flew from Tambo Airport in Johannesburg, I think it is, down to Port Elizabeth in the south of the country. And I had the whacking great coffin full of equipment, all the boxes and mics and whatnot. And it was Ray's first ever commentary. He'd never done a co-commentary, not even on a Premier League game. Alvin Martin had to go home. He was brought in to replace him. So his first game is the Netherlands against Brazil in the quarterfinals of a World Cup in South Africa, which is not too shabby. But ordinarily, I would have been incredibly nervous about, I've got to help Ray through this because there's certain things he may or may not know. But I was flapping so much about getting the bloody equipment to work and getting the line to connect back to London, having been given this phone number that was about 25 numbers long. Jesus, plus four. Oh. But I think we got through with about half an hour before airtime. So I was so consumed by that, it actually helped because I was then able to. I wasn't worrying about Ray for that hour, and he was fine in the end. He loved it, and it was a good game. And a good game always helps any summariser. I don't care who you are.
But doesn't that show you, Dan, that sometimes, well, always, these things are just a mindset in an individual, you know, in terms of being nerves, excitement, worry. I mean, I think to last weekend, I did Villa Brighton, so Steven Gerrard's first game. And in the car on the way up, you're thinking about the game and, you know, how you're going to go about your business and everything else. And then I was on the M1 and I saw that the junction was closed. And I thought to myself, oh, dear. This is going to be a problem. And I had my I had my phone out, and it was obviously in real time, you know, assessing the problem. And then all of a sudden, and I had arranged it so that I was going to be at the ground 3 hours early, because I always try and aim for that, because there's nothing worse than being late. And I saw it come from me arriving 3 hours before to it jumped suddenly to 2 hours before. And then I'm thinking, oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. This has never happened to me before. I hate this. And I'm in crawling traffic and it's not moving. So then you start to go into mental, right, what's the first thing you need to do here? What you need to do? And this is the difference, I think, in terms of who you're working for and what you're doing. Because if I was doing radio reports, for example, I'd need to think about, right, I need to phone the channel and tell them, and then need to phone the station and tell them, right, there's a possibility I might be late. You might not get reports from me from the first. But because I'm doing a TV comms and I know I need to be in action and giving stuff about an hour before kickoff anyway. So it's not about being there in time for kickoff. It's about being there in time for an hour before kickoff. So you're starting to sweat. So the first one, I thought, I've got to tell the co-com, who's Stephen Warnock, who's a brilliant guy. And I just said, I'm going to be late. He put some humor in there and all this sort of stuff. And I thought, I'm in a sort of situation here where I might not be finding anything funny. And as I know about Villa Park, and as I'm sure you both know, is that they close the roads, you know, the Trinity Road closed about an hour and a half before kickoff. Yeah. So I thought, if I'm not there an hour and a half before kickoff, I'm not going to be able to park near the ground or in the stadium. And that's another point. And fans will be arriving, so that will choke me even more. And so for all I'm thinking of for the next hour is being on time, what am I going to do? And I'm not thinking about the game at all. And I wasn't thinking about the game at all until I was walking up to the gantry and I knew I was safe and I was going to be fine, to cut a long story short.
How late were you in the end?
So I was there about, so it was a 3 o'clock kickoff and I was there about 5 to 2. Okay. So we're in the realms of flapping territory, but you're not in trouble. But yeah, this was the basis of knowing of why you always need to make, that's my first point in time, is logistics. Where am I going to park? Am I going to be there on time? If I have the possibility of being able to stay in a hotel or something and there's a risk, take that option, because, you know, the thought of missing a game gives me, you know, chills you to the bone. Oh, it's worse than that. I think my heart would be left on the M1. If I knew I was going to miss the game, I'd probably just turn the car around, go home and start looking for other work, I think.
Go on, Vicky.
I think my closest was 45 minutes. This is when I got a late call. It was reports rather than commentary. But they, you know, you still got to be on air. So that doesn't make a difference to the station. I got a late call from BBC London one day saying, can you go to Sheffield Wednesday tomorrow and do a game there? And I had a shift at BBC Newcastle. I thought, leave Newcastle at 4, get to Sheffield about 6. Absolutely fine. Idiot. Did not factor in traffic at all whatsoever. Travelling at that time, obviously. Got to the ground about 7. It was a 7:45 kickoff. You know, editors on the phone go, where are you? Where are you? Ran upstairs, you know, looked very quickly at the team news. I think got on air about 7:20, which was probably about 20 minutes later than they wanted, and did the team news and got in. But never again, I think I said to myself on the way home, like, you can't do that. And my timekeeping's not ideal, but it's never been as bad as that.
I must admit, I've told the story in here before about how I was late for a game at Bolton and actually missed the start of the game because of an accident on the motorway. But Tom Ross didn't kill me, and he could have done, and he would have been well within his rights to decapitate me for that. Funny, if it's all about nerves, I was nervous on Tuesday because I went to Chelsea Juventus to do the commentary for TalkSport. And as I sat there, it suddenly occurred to me that I'd never done an on-site Champions League commentary for the station before. Any commentary I'd done from the Champions League would have been a post-pandemic off-tube commentary from TalkSport Towers when we couldn't go out and we couldn't, you know, do that sort of thing. So suddenly this is unfamiliar territory. And Adrian Durham's looking at me, going, you're right, mate. Said, yeah, I'm fine. Don't worry. So you just go to your own little world and scribble down your team news and try and... But yeah, even moments like that, people think, you know, you've been doing it for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, that you don't get nervous anymore. You damn well do.
It shows you care. It shows you care. That's the thing. Having those little... Because people say, do you get nervous? But it's a tricky one, because it's more... You'll just have a feeling within your body that, like, oh, I need to be focused for this. But, you know, nerves can overcome people and they can shake and they can quiver and all that sort of stuff. But I'd say it's more just an alertness, just a tiny bit of anxiety, of the feeling of, right, I need to be on this. I need to know what's going on. I need to be focused. And I think that's a sign that you care, because when you don't have that, actually, that's when you can be in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, when you switch off, I've done off-tube games in the past where zero nerves for them. You switch off and you listen back to them, you just think, oh my God, I sound like I do not care about this game. I sound bored. I sound off it.
I'm not going to out this guy, but I've done, I've worked at Delta Trey in Wimbledon to do Europa League and Champions League commentaries. And there are 8 caves, where everyone commentates. And the caves are partitioned off with glass, so you can actually lean over and see who's next to you. And I'm not going to out the chap concerned, but I was doing your Europa League commentary, and I can't even tell you who was playing in the game I was doing, but I could sense there was something up against the glass from next door that wasn't natural, and I couldn't see the screen through the frosted glass of what was happening in the next. So I peer over the top whilst I'm commentating. The other guy... the reason I can't see anything, he's got his feet up on the desk, leaning back, commentating with a cigar on, basically. He's obviously bored out of his mind with what he's watching, because some Europa League games can be a bit of a trial, right? Can't they? this guy's just right. Do you know what? I'm getting paid. I could never do a commentary as casual.
I find for off tubes that like I have to stand up. I can't sit down and do it because otherwise I feel like Seb's laughing, but I can't. I stand up through all of them because otherwise I feel like I'm in my living room. I could have a cup of tea. I'm just sitting there watching the game. Wherever I can, I always stand for a commentary. Sometimes at ground you can't do it, but so much better for like your diaphragm and stuff. Again, this goes back to, you know, theatre GCSE and stuff, but having that kind of breathing, but off tubes, it's absolutely fundamental. And if I'm doing it with a summariser, I always say to them, look, you really don't have to. And they look at me a bit weirdly. I'm like, why are you standing like a kickoff? It's not national anthems anymore. But I find that it helps me focus because I separate my brain from I'm just sitting down watching football. I could be in my living room because it does feel like that sometimes, you know, when you do an off tube. But yeah, that's my focus hat on.
I like that. It's a very good point about the diaphragm and stuff, because you do all your commentary standing up, don't you, Seb? I mean, TV commentaries are all. You're all on a gantry. There's no such thing as sitting down doing a TV game, is there?
It depends on what ground it is. Because some grounds, you've got the fans right behind you, so you can't stand up, really. It's a tricky one. I mean, I'm trying to think of some that come to mind in that regard. I mean, I think about grounds like Arsenal, for example, where the fans are right behind you. You know, you have to be careful where you're standing and who's behind you. So if somebody who can't stand up, say in their own seat, because you know what football fans like, they stand up anywhere, and then you have to be aware of that, and you're conscious of blocking people's views, and sometimes, you know, you have no choice but to have to sit down. But if I can stand up, I'll be standing up, that's for sure, for the points that Vicky said. And also you're more alert when you're stood up. You can't, you know, it's impossible to fall asleep standing up, isn't it? I don't know. I've been on a few tubes. I don't know. Tubes, yeah.
Depends how drunk you are, Seb. If I stand up in a radio press box, I know I'm going to get things thrown at me within 10 seconds. So that standing up is not an option at places like Newcastle. And Vicky, you know Newcastle. Well, Newcastle as a radio, it can be so hazardous. Just a light drizzle drifting.
Oh, gosh. Honestly, I did a game there last year and I had to run to the car at half time to get the umbrella because it was that wet. I mean, it is you get absolutely drenched, and it was luckily it was a see-through one. And I, again, was doing reports and I balanced it on the little plastic see-through thing that was in front of me. I balanced it and sat under it for the second half and I could see what was going on. I'd lift it up to make sure, and luckily the umbrella was see-through. But goodness me, that is proper like notes gone territory. Yeah. If there's more than a thimble full of rain.
Yeah. But do you know what? When I think about those moments, I'm thinking more about, and I think it goes back to my background, I'm thinking more about the kit. Actually, I'm thinking more about, you know, the engineer's kit that they brought along, and it takes me up a story when I went to do we call them GVs, you know, shots of cities and landscapes for tournaments and things, and I did it for the Women's World Cup in Canada in 2015. And we were in Vancouver up in the mountains. Fantastic experience to be able to do this. And it was snowing up there. And there was bears, you know, brown bears, big bears that would rip your face off, I suppose. And they were on a level below us and we were filming them. And being up in the snow, I was really excitable about being in this sort of location. This is fantastic. There's bears down there. And you're going into a mode of like, you're a bit anxious because there's something that can kill you down there, but you're also like, this is an amazing experience. And I took myself almost out of being professional for just a split moment, and I picked up a snowball and I threw it at the cameraman, and the snowball ran down his body and onto his camera, and at that moment it snapped me back into the mode of, oh, hold on, what am I doing here? All right, I'm not on holiday. I'm a professional. And he was getting worried about his equipment. So whenever I think about moments where I'm out as a commentator, I'm out in the elements, I am just thinking about the equipment. Because if
don't throw a snowball. I thought you were going to say you threw the snowball at the bear.
Me too.
I wanted to...
Yeah.
We've got some great footage as it came straight down the barrel of the camera, are you?
Suddenly, literally, this bear juggling, right, he's having it.
Yeah, I think your podcast would be about 5 hours long if I told you these sort of stories. But yeah,
don't mind that at all. We are running short of time because we've talked for well over an hour. Let me just wrap things up. Vicky, your profile picture on your Twitter is a lovely picture of you at Wembley, clearly chatting pitch side with Claudio Ranieri. And of course, I've not talked about the pitch side reporter's job much because that's something I've done at cup finals. Arsenal Villa, I seem to remember as a touchline, which means there's a lot of responsibility. You've got to get out on that pitch at full time and elbow people out the way to get the exclusive interview. And well, you have to beat TalkSport and we have to beat Five Live, right? To get the interviews. It's an interesting role, isn't it?
It is very much. Yeah, I think that must have been from the Community Shield back in 2016 when Leicester played there. And yeah, I mean, what a gentleman, Claudio Ranieri. How can you not love him? But yeah, I think it's, yeah, there is a, it's difficult, isn't it? Because like you say, Doug, I think we get on really well, like as two stations as well. I think I have so much respect and camaraderie with so many people at TalkSport that I see on the circuit and stuff. But I think it's that post-match interview slot where you suddenly the competitiveness comes out, doesn't it? Because whoever's live, whoever's going straight back into their show, and you're very aware that like your producers back at base want various things and stuff. But yeah, I think what I find it a lot easier to do. I mean, you get used to it as a commentator, but it goes back to what you were saying earlier, Seb, about really being in the moment when you're doing the commentary. That actually, when you've been doing reports, I think you sit back so much more and have much more of a reflective approach to the game, because you know at the end of the match you're going to need to summarize it in 20 seconds. So you're constantly thinking about the balance of the game and how do I sum this up, whereas for commentary you are in the moment every single second. That is your job. And so actually when you finish the game, and I think again it's something you learn with time, and I feel I've got better at it over time, but I find reporting games much easier to do post-match interviews afterwards than commentary, particularly early on, because with commentary you're so in the moment, and then actually if you're rushing downstairs, you're rushing down the gantry, you're straight in front of the manager to kind of think, okay, what is my 30 second summary of that, like picking out key points, that's fairly easy, you know, to talk about the goals or what it means and stuff, but actually you're so in the moment sometimes, and particularly if it's been like a really exciting ending or whatever, that's so fresh in your mind. You've got to think about, hang on a minute, what's this? How would I assess the first half? Like, how would I kind of talk to them about that sort of thing? So I think that's another challenge within commentary to make sure that you're still really having that overall grasp of the game, even if that's as you come off the gantry.
Have you ever turned your hand to that, Seb? Touchline reporting or anything like that we've done?
So, yeah, when I spoke about those Al Jazeera days, I actually did a bit of InVision reporting, did the interviews post-match. I have to say, and I have to do a bit of that for Sky, actually, at this present time. But I have to say, you know, I've always, as I said, I've done almost every job in television, it feels like. And I still, nothing beats commentating for me, because it's my heart's always been there. So even when I'm doing reporting, I understand, or I get the notion that everything becomes a skill and a profession. And when I have to do commentary games and then go down and do the interviews, your mind is not in the same zone as a reporter's should be or would be at that moment in time, because you've just come fresh off a commentary where you've given a lot of, you know, effort and you've been speaking a lot and you've there's a lot of emotion in there and you've thrown all sorts of things in, and your general overview of the game, you've quickly summed it up in your full-time wrap. But in terms of getting those little details to challenge the managers on, or just ask the managers about, it's not, I always come away from those thinking, unlike the commentary where I feel like, you know, I'm okay. I come away from the interviews thinking, oh, I don't know, that was a little rubbish. But actually what I do quickly realize is it's not about me with those interviews. And I've started to get that over the years, just thinking, just quickly get the manager talking, just get them talking, and you'll get the managers. I mean, Sam Allardyce is a great example where you can throw him one question and he'll answer your next five.
Yeah.
In one swoop.
And we've got no other questions to ask. Well, guess that's it then.
I tend to just press them. If I feel like they've touched on it, I'll just ask them again, but say, honestly, come on. That's when you get the funny answers of, oh, I answered it already.
I do get exasperated with the How important a win was that for you today? Line of questioning. How important was... I'm just waiting for... If Gordon Strachan was still in management, we all know the answer he'd have given to that particular question. He'd have gone, no, wasn't important at all. Wrote a lot of rubbish. You know, it's sometimes... but that can come, in their defence, from a scrambled mind, from... As you say, Seb, having done a full 90-minute commentary where you're completely in a zone, the adrenaline's coursing through your veins, and suddenly you've got to have a completely different perspective on what you've watched. And so maybe it's a lazy question to ask, but I don't know. It's just want to settle your brain down, I suppose, and see how the manager's temperament is as he starts to talk to you.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, because I've seen some reporters... You know, and especially junior ones, they'll write their questions. They've got their questions written down, say, and the manager's answering, and they're looking ahead, right? What's my next question? Everything else. And actually, I've quickly abandoned ever doing that sort of policy. I'll think, what's my first question? And I might think, what's my last question? But the rest, I try and do them on the fly, especially after I've just done a commentary, because I want to be listening to the manager and hear what they have to say. And then I tend to have a technique of, you know, even I think back to the last one I did was the Villa game. And that's another thing, because you've got to go through the away fans to get to that position. Yeah. And I did the derby against Wolves, and you could say they were still in there. So that was tough. That was a challenge. That was the biggest challenge of the day, getting through them. But, you know, and speaking to Gerrard after the game, I just felt, because I knew it was his first game, I just wanted to almost just get him smiling a bit. So I was smiling a lot during the interview to get him smiling, because it wasn't a serious thing. It's like he's won the game and he's now a Premier League manager. Just get him happy about it and give that buzz and feel like he's part of, you know, Villa and everything else. And then you get there. And then when you do the losing manager, you know, you're a lot more serious. There's less smiling because you're like, they're not going to be smiling. They're not going to find this funny. And that's just what's going through your mind at that time. But it you know, it's a different skill, just like every other job in television or radio is, because you become a professional, it becomes your career, and you always get better with experience.
I think that sums it up perfectly. I think having held every... I don't think you've held every job in ITV, Seb. You're not running ITV yet, but surely that's... Surely that's to come. Somewhere down the line. Listen, guys, we might as well wrap it up there, because we've spoken for pretty much an hour and a half there, talking about this weird world we inhabit and we love it. Where are you guys this weekend? What are your gigs coming up? Vicky, where are you this weekend?
So I am very excited, off to the Stadium of Light to see England women take on Austria in the World Cup qualifiers, which should be a really good one. And then at Manchester City, West Ham for 5 Live on Sunday.
Excellent. And Seb, how about you?
I'm off to the Stadium of Light to watch England play against
Austria. You know what? Seb and I are always at the same game, and then we'll hear each other and we'll message and go, I was on the gantry, where were you? Yeah, I didn't get on the good gantry at Villa. I was on the lower down gantry. I was like, we're not up. Oh, no, Sky are up there. I was like, all right, we'll just stay
there. It happens all the time. You know, I didn't realise you were doing that game. I heard you.
So now we'll get to actually live.
Absolutely. Right. I'm going up tomorrow, so I'll be up there early. And then on Sunday, I've got Leicester Watford. So, you know, I'll be watching as part of my prep the second half of their Europa League game, because I caught the first half. I love to bounce between different competitions. Some people think it's difficult, but I love that, because it gives you the variety, and ultimately it's football.
You're right. I've got Premier League, FA Cup and Papa John's Trophy in the next 4 or 5 days, so I'm going through the card. I'm off to Palace Villa on Saturday, so maybe I can get Steven Gerrard smiling if Villa have got an away win, and I'll be interested to see how many times he says "yeah, of course," as that brilliant impressionist Darren Farley has picked up on so brilliantly during his time at Rangers and whatnot. Listen, guys, what a pleasure it's been to get you on the podcast. It's been a long time coming, get you guys on, but we finally managed it. Seb, all the best for women's football, Sky, BT, and of course the World Cup next year. I hope to see you out there in Qatar, and you too, Vicky. I hope, you know, once again the BBC will see fit to employ you both on the wireless and on the goggle box to do the World Cup next year.
Well, the one thing I'll say, Dance, is that in Qatar, we will see each other because it's that small an area.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to, you might be in Sochi and I'll be in Samara, or whatever. This will be, we'll be around the corner, whatever happens.
Drinks will be taken at some point.
Possibly.
Yeah, a standard chat. Oh, cool. What's a dry, maybe a lilt. Yeah, it's a dry country, isn't it? Yeah. I have to stick to water.
I think Heineken will make their way in.
Somehow. Oh, yeah, but there might be a blue chip partner might, yeah, might find its way in. Alan Brazil special coffees, that might have to be the way of the... there's no coffee quite like an Alan Brazil coffee, I can tell. All right, Vicky, Seb, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast. All the best to you guys.
Thank you.
Oh, you too, Dan. It's been fab.
So my thanks to Seb Hutchinson and Vicky Sparks for joining me on the Commentator's Curse. Another episode to come next time. Our archive is there for you to leaf through, and all the previous episodes are there to enjoy. Ian Dancer signing off. Join us next time on the Commentator's Curse.